Good evening.
Excuse my scratchiness. How you doing? It's time for the Vibrational Voyage on KKUP Cupertino, 91.5 FM. Hey, pretty cool outside right now. Pretty intense, too. Some good wind has been blowing in. Definitely energetic wind. And the rain was coming down. And I have to share this with you. Went outside, it was, I don't know, probably around 10:30 or so. Yeah, right out back at my home, the moon was out, but it was also raining. And I was kind of getting this little sprinkling of rain. I just stepped out there for a minute to see if the moon was out there. And, of course, the moon's approaching full moon. And tonight it's actually kind of extraordinary. Briefly, once each month, the moon is with one of the planets. Well, just so happens that tonight, the moon, where it is right now, approaching full, not there yet. It's got to go till the morning of the 18th. So evening of the 17th, morning of the 18th will be the exact full moon. And right now, the moon is positioned exactly together with Neptune right now this evening. And it's also kind of right dead in the middle of where Neptune and Chiron are. Neptune and Chiron are just slightly spread apart. And the moon's at the degree, which is right in the middle of the angle between those two. So that's kind of extraordinary. That doesn't happen. Well, likelihood that it would happen at this time of night is pretty rare, too, that it would be going on. But we have the good fortune to have that in the background tonight for our voyage. So I wanted to mention that not only is the moon right in between Neptune and Chiron right now, but the full moon, which is about to bloom for us here, the sun and Chiron, I had it screwed up. It's actually the Sun and Neptune that are together right now. And, of course, Chiron's right next to Neptune. So I was going on and on about the moon. Well, the moon will be opposite to Neptune and Chiron, exactly opposite at the time of the full moon. And the sun will be together with them. So you see how that works, of course. It's pretty straightforward. Probably most folks who pay attention could reason that one out. If you kind of sense the positions of things. Well, anyway, that has an interesting effect on what's going on. And, that's right. Tonight we also have the moon trine Uranus. The moon and Uranus in a really harmonious angle. And so that one's nice for, I don't know, it strikes me now as having to do with a blending and something that has a nice synergy to it. So that's what we have tonight. We actually have tonight, we have the moon trining Uranus, and we have the sun conjoining Neptune, and of course Chiron. And this whole event is going to bloom and kind of culminate in something, I'd say, with the full moon that's happening this Thursday night, Friday morning. All righty. Well, I brought a few things for you tonight, I thought I'd maybe grab a few things from the last few months or so. It's been busy. I was out of town last week. Thanks if you tuned in last week. I was gone. Michael Berry filled in. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everybody who tuned in and listened. That's kind of like a different kind of voyage, but still a great journey. I hope you guys all had fun together. Yeah, oh man, and there's so many good Terence McKenna pieces too. God, maybe I'll whip a couple of these on for you again. You know, you can't hear these things too frequently, it seems to me. So, yeah, I hope you're having a good week. We've got a little bit of winter back together with us here now. And so that kind of puts us into a slightly different mode. But we have something approaching us, which is a real amazing springtime event. For the spring equinox, the actual date, which is March 20th, the Sun and Uranus will be together. Uranus and the Sun together at that spring equinox point. I know I was talking to Tiger about it. He said, well, that's like a direct sign of what we might call the Aquarian Age. Uranus, the ruler of Aquarius. So anyway, that's something that's coming up for us here pretty quickly, just within the month of March. Watch for that. All right, well, why don't we dive into a little bit of Terrence. I think you'll enjoy this.
With this, and without any further ado, I am most pleased and most happy to introduce our very special guest speaker tonight, Terrence McKenna.
To be here. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces and so many faces, period. I've never been to Port Hueneme before. Probably some of you feel the same way. But I've been doing a lot of traveling recently. I was in New York last weekend at the Open Center, and in Prague 2 weeks before that. So this is the end of a long season of traveling. I'm not home yet, but at least I'm in my own time zone. I want to especially thank Andy Voth and the Carnegie Museum of Art in Oxnard for inviting me to participate. It represents a real commitment to free speech and First Amendment rights, I think, for an art museum. Art museums have been taking some knocks recently, and so I think they doubly should be commended for their courage. And I want to explain, as Andy mentioned, this is a benefit for Botanical Dimensions, which explains the double price over the ticket. All of this money will go to the preservation of medicinal plants with a history of shamanic usage. That is the special focus of our botanical garden in Hawaii. And before I start the formal lecture, I'd like to just say a little bit about that. As you know, the rainforests of the world are being cleared at a very frightening rate. And perhaps voices are beginning to be heard to halt this destruction of the natural environment. But whether it's halted or not, the destruction of the knowledge of native peoples concerning the uses of the plants in the rainforest, this is disappearing without doubt in the next 30 years, because these people are moving into cities, taking jobs in the ordinary market economy, and thousands of years of accumulated folk medical knowledge is being lost. So the real world political work that Kat and I do is associated with Botanical Dimensions. We conceived it together many, many years ago, and then about 6 years ago, Kat took it over, put it on its official feet, made it a non-profit foundation, and has run it day to day since then, with tremendous energy and efficiency. So I'd like to acknowledge Kat McKenna here. my better half. In fact, my only good half. Yes. And then I wanted to underscore what Andy said, a very special event 2 weeks from now at the Carnegie Museum. Roy Tuckman, Roy of Hollywood, bon vivant, countercultural figure, informational ferret of our time, will be recast as an experimental composer of great energy and imagination. And I hope you'll all turn out for Roy. He's been a wonderful force in my life, and I think in the cultural life of Southern California. Both Roy and Diane have done a wonderful job in raising the quality of public dialogue in Southern California, which I think is a precondition for any kind of clear thinking about our future or our political situation. So, here's to Roy and Diane. Okay. Well, the theme that unites these lectures is creativity and the techniques by which the artist can refine his or her vision, expand the vision, communicate the vision. And before I get into that issue, I thought I would talk just a little bit about my notion of creativity per se. What is it in and of itself? And when I think like that, of course, I cast my mind back to nature. Nature is the great visible engine of creativity against which all other creative efforts are measured. And creativity in nature has a curious distribution. It's something which accumulates through time. If we stand back and look at the universe, we see that at its earliest moments, it was very simple. It was a plenum. It was without characters or characteristics. It was what in Hindu mythology is called the Turaya, which is described as attributeless. And naturally, if something is without attribution, you can't say much about it. It takes a while for it to undergo a declension into more creative realms. And these creative realms are distinguished as domains of difference. The precondition for creativity is, I think, disequilibrium, what mathematicians now call chaos. And through the life of the universe, as temperatures have fallen, more and more complex compound structures have arisen. And though there's been many a slipping back in this process, over very large spans of time, we can say that creativity is conserved, that the universe becomes more creative. And out of that state of creative fecundity, more creativity is manifest. So that from that point of view, the universe is almost what we would have to call an art-making machine, an engine for the production of ever more novel forms of connectedness, ever more exotic juxtapositions of disparate elements. And out of this, I believe, arises implicitly a set of principles that we can then apply to the human artist in the human world. Nature's creativity is obviously the wellspring of human creativity. We emerge out of nature almost, and this idea I think was fairly present close to the surface of the medieval mind, we emerge out of nature almost as its finest work of art. The medieval mind spoke of the productions of nature. This is a phrase you hear as late as the 18th century, the productions of nature. And human creativity emerges out of that, whether you have a model of the Aristotelian great ladder of being or a more modern evolutionary view where we actually consolidate emergent properties and somehow bring them to a focus of self-reflection. Now, I'm sure that we couldn't carry out a discussion of this sort without observing that the prototypic figure for the artist, as well as for the scientist, is the shaman. The shaman is the figure at the beginning of human history that unites the doctor, the scientist, and the artist into a single notion of caregiving and creativity. And I think that, you know, to whatever degree art over the past several centuries has wandered in the desert, it is because this shamanic function has been either suppressed or forgotten. And we've different images of the artist have been held up at different times. The artist as artisan, the artist as handmaiden of a ruling class or family, the artist as designer for the production of integrated objects into a civilization. This notion of the artist as mystical journeyer, as one who goes into a world unseen by others and then returns to tell them of it, was pretty much lost in the post-medieval and Renaissance conception of art up until the late 19th century or early 20th century, where, beginning with the Romantics, there is a new permission to explore the irrational. This really is the bridge back to the archaic shamanic function of the artist. Permission to explore the irrational. The Romantics did it with their elevation of titanic emotion, romantic love specifically. The symbolists in the mid-19th century did it by a re-emphasis on the emotional content of the image and a rejection of the previous rationalism. And that emphasis on the image and on the emotions set the stage then for what I take to be the truly shamanic movements in art, which begin really with Alfred Jarry in the late 1880s and early 1890s. Jarry, you may remember, was the founder of something called the École du Pataphysique, the Pataphysical College. Jarry announced pataphysics is the science. The problem was nobody could understand what it meant or what it stood for, including Jarry. Jarry was tight with Lontremont, who you may recall said, "I am fascinated with that kind of beauty that arises when a sewing machine meets a bicycle on an operating table." See, this was a true effort to bend the boundaries of art, to create new permission really for the unthinkable. And this, again, reinforces the shamanic function. What do we mean when we say the unthinkable? We mean the envelope. both of that which can be conceived, and for at least 200 years, the ostensible mission of the artist has been to test the conceptual and imagistic envelope of what the society is willing to tolerate. And this has taken many forms. The deconstruction of imagery that we get with abstract expressionism, going back into impressionism and the pointillism, or the permission for the irrational imagery of the unconscious, surrealism, and German expressionism make use of this permission. Always the idea being to somehow destroy the idols of the tribe.
Dissolve the conceptual boundary of ordinary expectation. Well, in order to do this, it seems to me there is a precondition for the creation of art, which I call understanding. And I don't mean this in an intellectual sense. I mean it in the sense that Alfred North Whitehead intended when he defined understanding as the apperception of pattern as such. As such. There's nothing more to it than that. You see, if we were to look at this room and we were to squint our eyes, and I'm doing this right now, and I see that the room divides itself into people dressed in red and people dressed in blue. This is a pattern, and it tells me something about what I'm looking at. Now I shift my depth of field. Now I'm looking at where men are sitting and where women are sitting. This is a different pattern, and it tells me more about what I am looking at. The number of these patterns, theoretically present in any construction, is infinite. That says to me, then, that the depth of understanding cannot be known. It cannot be known. Everything is immanent. William Blake makes this point, you know, that you can see infinity in a grain of sand. So understanding, then, is the precondition for creativity. History is a kind of horrified realization that something has been lost, that there is an itch hard to scratch in the civilized context, that we have, out of fear, really, descended into patterns of domination of each other, of the environment, of our children, of our social relations with exogamous groups. We have descended into a dominator pattern that is basically based on clutching, on fear. And I'm sure most of you have heard me argue that this is the consequence of ceasing basically to do enough hallucinogens in the diet. That, in fact, what human beings were flirting with over many, many tens of millennia, let's say from 100,000 years ago to 15,000 years ago, human beings were in a flirtatious situation with a symbiotic relationship with this mind resident in vegetable nature. Now, you all know that what classic symbiosis is in biology. It's where, let's take the example of the little fish who lives in the sea anemone, and big fish don't bother it. It gains protection. The sea anemone gains access to larger prey, which come to investigate the little fish. That kind of symbiosis is genetically locked in. And if you take the little fish away from the anemone and put it, let us say, in an aquarium without anemones,
It doesn't die. It doesn't go into an immediate physiological crisis. No, what happens is it simply has a low body weight and a short lifespan. In other words, it is under stress. And I believe, I hope I'm not deluding myself, but I believe that the lost secret of human emergence, the undefined catalyst that took a very bright monkey and turned that species into a tormented, self-reflecting poet dreamer, that catalyst has to be sought in these tertiary alkaloids in the food chain that were catalyzing higher states of intellectual activity. And I've pointed out to you ad nauseum, I'm sure, the reciprocal feedback relationship that was working there in the case of the mushroom in the veldt situation in Africa. It was promoting at low doses visual acuity, which was feeding back into the hunting and gathering process, making those animals with this increased visual acuity more adaptively successful, hence more reproductively successful, hence they're outbreeding their competitors. At higher doses, psilocybin actually causes a generalized arousal, which includes sexual arousal. Again, it becomes a catalyst for increased reproductive success. More instances of copulation in a situation like that lead to more successful births of those into family structures where the alkaloid has been accepted into the food chain. Well, this would be only an obscure topic of interest to primatologists were it not for the fact that it is a crisis in consciousness which confronts us globally. Consciousness is the commodity that if we do not have enough of it, do not produce it fast enough, then the momentum of the processes we set in motion in our ignorance is going to sterilize the planet and do us all in. So we have to have consciousness. Well, then you look at the smorgasbord of ethnographic possibilities and you discover this institution of shamanism. It is the institution of planner, of visionary, of manager, of large system coordinator. That's what it's about. You call it magic on one level. You call it curing. You call it folk psychiatry or weather prediction. Shamans have been involved in all of these things. But as Nicole was made so eloquently the point last night, to these deep forest people, it is ordinary. It is ordinary. They live in a different cultural dimension than we do. Dimensions which to us are completely value dark are to them completely transparent. And dimensions which to us are extremely rich and complex, the inner world of the nucleus of the atom, let us say, are for them totally value dark. They don't even cognize the possibility of asking the question. But nevertheless, the specialization in these very various domains is not something where one is as good as another. Consciousness is the domain of immediate experience. How are we going to save this planet? How are we going to take the lethal cascade of toxic, technological, and ignorance-producing habits that are loose on this planet and channel them toward some kind of a sane and livable world? Well, the answer is emerging in culture out of the collectivity of global consciousness. It is what I call the archaic revival. It is this very large turnover in the mass mind. Some people call it a paradigm shift. It's an effort to recover the sensory ratios, the feelings, and the attitudes of 15 to 20,000 years ago, before fear, before ego, before male dominance, before hierarchy, hoarding, warfare, propaganda, child abuse, all of these things. And the answer lies, as was indicated last night, in integration into the dynamics of nature. Well, so far as my analysis gives it to me, the only way you can abandon yourself to the dynamics of nature is to break through the language shell. You must cut through the aura of programming and cultural assumptions that surround us from the moment we are able to speak. The only way this can be done is by dissolving the boundaries of ego. Ego is a structure that is erected by a neurotic individual who is a member of a neurotic culture against the facts of the matter. And culture, which we put on like an overcoat, culture is the collectivized consensus about what sort of neurotic behaviors are acceptable. Now, I don't know. So, you see, what I see going on in the Amazon is a very radical psycholytic therapy where they are dissolving, literally dissolving, the boundaries of self, culture, and ego assumption. And then what you discover is not the white light, or what William James called a blooming, buzzing confusion, although in the first few minutes it can be like that. But what you really discover is sentient, organized, living, loving nature. That nature is a force. Nature is a mind, a personality, organized with intentionality, organized with feeling, humor, grace, and conviction. Conviction. And if you can get right with that conviction, then that's the secret of dancing in the waterfall. That's the secret of the shaman's apparent transcendence of the rules of mundane statistics. Because that is what it is. The shaman doesn't violate physics. He or she simply knows how to push the improbable to its greatest extent. And in Eastern philosophy, this is called the Tao. You know, abandonment to the flow. Fitting of the small pattern into the larger pattern. Well, I think these things are very important because I think that psychology, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, it's a good idea, but it will never reach any kind of operational effectiveness until we look to these native healers all over the world and study their methods. And their methods are chemical and personal. It's a combination of care, attention, intention, and chemistry that allows consciousness to be made malleable and then recast in other forms. So I find myself this weekend explaining myself. That's what I feel like I'm doing. Why does someone who extols the self-transforming elf machines of the DMT space also claim to be a conservationist, also, you know, have a mathematical dog and poodle show? Well, it's because all of these things emerge out of the concrescence of consciousness, its intention toward its own transformation. Nature is the answer. It's not enough to be like Wordsworth. It's not enough to... this is not, you know, Mao Zedong said the revolution is not a dinner party. And certainly the ecological revolution is not a dinner party. Poetic sensitivity to the death of the planet is not what we're striving for here. What we're striving for is to halt, overturn, and back out of the impending death of the planet. It is very clear now that consciousness will decide, that the planet, there are not rosy futures of suburban housing and ratatouille to be extended endlessly into the future. We are approaching a bifurcation where it is either going to become heaven or hell, one or the other. And I think that this archaic intuition, which I see reaching clear back to the birth of the 20th century and the 19th century, back to people like Alfred Jarry and Guillaume Apollinaire and the pataphysicians, the surrealists, the physicists around Einstein, Freud, modern art, modern dance, jazz, all of this stuff is an effort to reclaim the primitive, to reclaim the archaic, to reject all that powdered wig algebra that comes down through the French, English, German tradition of constipated male dominance. And instead, you know, intuit, that's what it is in Freud and Jung and the New Age, and intuit our way out. But now, the intuition is rising to the surface. We no longer have to operate without the presence of the goal firmly in hand. The goal can now be stated. What this is all about is a return to archaism with the lessons learned in history. That's where we were happy. The fall was a fall into a veil of tears, into a world of limitation and pain and suffering and infectious disease and so forth and so on. It's a prodigal journey into a lower dimension that can now be ended by a collective cultural decision to commit to this Taoist, shamanistic, feminized, cybernetic, caring, aware, present kind of being. I mean, it's nothing more than what each of us is in our very best moments. But we have to extend those very best moments to fill whole lifetimes. Think of the number of people who suffered and died that we could sit under this tree this morning. I mean, in the last million years, 9 times the glaciers have ground south from the poles, freezing the world into ice and confining human populations to subtropical valleys and the warm tropics. 9 times the interglacial periods have come and human populations have spread out over the earth. They didn't have radio, they didn't have antibiotics, contraception, statistical analysis, or the partial differential equation, and yet somehow they managed to get us here. Are we then, as the heirs of that wavefront, of the inheritors of a billion-year process, are we in one generation to turn it into a massive pottage? I think not. I certainly hope not. I would like to believe that we could make that leap to conscious awareness that would allow us to take hold. Now, the problem, it was easy the first 10 years that I sat before you, because what we were doing was getting to know each other, to verify that we in fact existed, that I wasn't crazy, you weren't crazy, so forth and so on. Now what looms ahead is the mess of politics. And this, I'm sure you have no stomach for. I certainly don't. I'd rather be stoned and rocked in the arms of the goddess. But as a matter of fact, this dominator thing is not going to be unhooked and put to bed without a struggle. Everyone is going to have to be counted. I've talked to you in recent months about memes. Memes being the smallest potential units of ideas. They're like genes. we are the nucleus of a mutant meme, the meme of plant consciousness, hallucinogenic consciousness, shamanistic consciousness. We have to refine this meme, replicate it through repetition, and spread it through society in the same way that a plant sheds seeds into an ecosystem. The idea will compete. The idea is a good one. It's adaptive. It's clever. It's tough. It's invasive. It can make use of many contexts to promote its own existence. But it can't do any of that if we don't replicate it and get it out. So I see these kinds of meetings as an opportunity for building community, as an opportunity for people to look around themselves and connect with the other people who are here. We cannot be told from the rest of the population unless we self-select and gather together at a single point in space and time. When we do that, we recognize each other. When this meeting is concluded, we will merge back into the larger stream of the body politic. But carrying this meme of the Gaian resurgence, the Gaelanic wave that must come. I mean, people say it's so wonderful that you articulate these feminist ideas and so forth. I do it because I don't want to be dead. I do it because I don't want my children to have no world to live in. There is no choice. The walls are high and the current is moving very fast. What we need to do is merely keep our spirits high and learn to sing the song. My friend Ralph Abraham is a proponent of this school of mathematics called chaotic attractors or dynamics. And this is the notion that many processes are not pushed from behind by the momentum of casuistry, as in the ordinary Newtonian model of process, but that there are what he calls attractors, or basins of attraction. And these are things which lead processes forward. For instance, a somewhat trivial example would be if we had a large bowl and a marble, and every time we released the marble up near the rim of the bowl, we would notice that it unfailingly rolled to the bottom of the bowl and located itself somewhere near the center of the bottom of the bowl, we could say that the bottom of the bowl acts as a basin of attraction for the marble. In other words, the marble finds its most, that its energy state is most at equilibrium when it locates itself in the trough of the bowl. So there is a way of analyzing processes to see them as though they were led rather than pushed. And I think it's fruitful to see human history this way. You see, what we deny as a culture of materialist, positivist, reductionists, is the presence of spirit in the world, in ourselves, or in nature. And so Western science is very concerned to deny what is called telos. Telos is a Greek term for purpose. Purpose. The same idea as the attractor that I was trying. If you have a target, if you're driving a car toward a goal, the goal is your telos. It decides how you will steer the car. Well, it has been for the past 150 years extremely fashionable in sociology and biology because of Darwin to deny telos in nature, to say that, you know, any apparent order in nature is made up of the disorder of random mutation meeting the disorder of natural selective processes, and these two streams of converging disorder create a kind of apparent or virtual order, which is an illusion. This is the orthodox theory. And when you take this Darwinism and put it into historical theory of human processes in time, you get the modern position in academic philosophy about history, which is that it is, and the official phrase is, trendlessly fluctuating. That's what we are asked to believe we are embedded in, a 10,000-year-old process of trendless fluctuation. In mathematics, this is called a random walk. It means you just go over here a few steps, and then you go this way, and then you go back. You're like a drunk lurching around in this phase space. And this is the highest vision of human purpose that the reductionist vision can offer. Well, what the intuition of religion is, especially Western religion, and I wouldn't even bother to mention it, except that it also is the strong intuition of a lot of psychedelic experience, that there is some kind of attractor in the historical phase space. There is something which is drawing everything toward it. It's like a higher dimensional entity that casts an enormous shadow over the human landscape, so that, you know, at sitting around campfires 50,000 years ago, people felt this vague tug toward organization, order, cognitive activity, epigenetic activity. Epigenetic activity means coding stuff not in your genes, but in dance, gesture, ritual, and ultimately in clay and on paper and in electronic storage methods. This proliferation of complexity is a response to and an anticipation of this transcendental object at the end of historical process. You see, if it weren't for our presence on this planet, even modern science at its present primitive state could give a fairly good accounting of what's going on, that out of complex polymers arose super complex polymers which were self-replicating, and that was life, and then you have an animal population. But the fly in the ointment of this rational model of reality is ourselves. We are clearly imbued with a higher dimension, which we call spirit, in a way that ordinary matter, when imbued with a higher dimension, is called life. In other words, we represent a different ontological level in the career of organization, because we hope, we despair, we plan, we remember, and we misremember. You know, we lie, we fabricate, we delude ourselves and other people. All of these things are uniquely human functions. Well, I think that shamanism, which is the focus of our concern here, is a kind of anticipating of the whole pattern. And that this is really the way to think about shamanism when thinking of it as a force that can steady and complete an individual human life. The shamans are not in history in the same way that we are. By having access to this higher dimension that they go to in their trance states and their states of intoxication, they gain a fractal overview on process, on life. I mean, after all, isn't that what we mean by wisdom? Wisdom is understanding how things really work, how they really work. Love affairs, the raising of children, the managing of corporations, the prosecution of wars. How do these things really work? Not the deluded and fumbling attempts of the proponents of this or that school, but a Taoistic insight into the actual appropriate dynamics of everything. Well, how do you gain that kind of an insight? The answer is, you must have a superior model. You must have a superior model. Now, if you believe, you know, that the world is composed of three levels and they are held up on the back of a woman who sits on a giant tortoise who floats in space, this is a model of the universe. It can take you a certain distance. But what model of the universe can actually offer reassurance in all kinds of situations? Well, strangely enough, I think that these models come from the frontiers of mathematics, that it is not mere coincidence that the storms of visionary hallucination that the shaman encounters are very much like the storms of form and color that are spewed out of a Cray 3 supercomputer when it conducts 1,000 iterations per second inside the Julia set or the Mandelbrot set or one of these other compound complex mathematical objects that we are beginning to see. You see, mathematics, up to this point, has been a computational science because mathematicians used pencils and blackboards and chalk to describe their objects. And consequently, an excruciatingly difficult vocabulary kept most people from appreciating what mathematics was about. Now, the computer is to modern mathematics like the telescope was to 16th century astronomy. The computer becomes a window into domains of hyper-complex computability that previously could barely even be conceived, but that now, at a rate of millions approaching billions of iterations per second, Ralph works on the MMPP machine, the multiple parallel processing machine at Goddard Space Flight Center. It does 800 megaflops per second, 800 million floating point decimal calculations per second. Well, you can dream dreams with a machine like that, and strangely enough, at the edge of the super technology of the Dominator culture at Goddard Space Flight Center with guys, high priests standing around in white coats, when you get it up and running, what you see is what an ayahuasca shaman sees on a Saturday night in the Amazon. You see that you are navigating through a complex, higher dimensional phase space where by varying the inputs of amplitude and frequency, in one case using an electronic box, in the other case using the human voice, you sing your way through a mathematical domain which is a higher resonance of reality. And you learn how the world really works, how things happen. Well, how the hell do they happen? Well, on the simplest level, they happen like this. They have a beginning, they have a middle, and then they die away as an oscillation, a damped oscillation. Now this simple truth to which we all nod assent is in fact the hardest thing, the hardest swallow there is for the dominator ego and the dominator personality. Because what this simple truth says, things come into being, they achieve their inflorescence and they fade away, is, as Heraclitus put it, pantithreia, all flows. Nothing lasts. Nothing is saved. And this is, you know, our glory and our agony. That, you know, the people we love and the people we hate are swept away by time. Empires, dynasties, continents are swept away by time. And yet our search for security is cast in the dominator culture as a search for permanence. You know, I want to buy a house. I'd like to get my trust fund functioning a little better. I'd like to pay off X, Y, and Z. You know, a search for permanence. So what you do when you do that is you set yourself at war against the cosmos, which is a heroic stance if you're trying to produce Melvillian opera out of your life. You know, Ahab says in Moby Dick, he's talking to his first mate, Starbuck, who signifies Christian right reason, and he says, he's raving about going after the whale, and he says, we'll chase it over both sides of Earth and round perdition's flame. And Starbuck says, to seek revenge on a dumb brute seems blasphemy. And he says, blasphemy, Starbuck, speak not to me.
We are just totally out of time. But I want to say thank you so much for listening. Enjoy that full moon this week. That's will be full moon with Sun conjunct Neptune and Chiron. Pretty amazing. It'll be directly with Chiron. All right, I got to get out of here. Stay tuned. The King Man's up next with some great music. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to KKUP Cupertino, 91.5 FM. And this has been Vibrational Voyage Program. We'll be right back.